Traditionally, this is the time when we take a backwards look at the old year. So perhaps you'll join us in remembering some of the highlights of 1986 on Outlook, during which we gave in quite frequently to that urge to wander.
Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland.
Hello, and welcome to Jerusalem. And from here, there's a wonderful view of the church.
Hello, and welcome to Outlook and Carnival Week in Rio de Janeiro. Of all the cities in the world, this is where national...
Karibuni wasikilizaji. Welcome to Kenya, one of Africa's fairest and most fortunate...
You know, I can think of no more agreeable way of inviting you to join me in Antigua than sitting here...
Reminders that we strayed on many occasions from the cosy fastness of our Outlook studios in Bush House. Whatever the fates have in store round the corner, at least we can embark on each new year in a positive frame of mind. And that's how the gleaming, pencil-slim Superbird Concorde started 1986, celebrating in January its first decade in service. Graham Hill joined in the general mood of celebration. He was aboard Flight 163 from London's Heathrow Airport.
Off we go. You can hear the tremendous roar of the Rolls-Royce Olympus engines zooming down the runway. Must be hitting around 100 miles an hour now. Here we go. 80 tons of thrust, and up goes that famous rapier nose. About 30 seconds, we're airborne. Absolutely brilliant. And for 3.5 hours now, I'll be joining the beautiful people on what I'm sure will be the most exciting flight of my life.
And what's the betting he had to let out that seatbelt a few notches to allow for the sumptuous roast goose, washed down by champagne that was coming his way as he stretched out in supersonic comfort. But whilst Graham and his fellow travellers lived a sybaritic life, there were others, of course, for whom the flight was a serious business.
Captain McNeely, we're just beginning our descent now to New York. A bank, a maze of instruments before us here. How are we doing?
We're holding level at the moment at 57,300 feet because we've just started our deceleration. Ordinarily, during the crossing, we're in a cruise climb technique where the power setting remains constant, the speed remains constant, and as the aircraft becomes lighter, we gain altitude. We've now started to decelerate towards subsonic speeds. Therefore, we are holding level at 57,300 feet. The speed has just started to decrease from our cruising Mach 2 towards 1.6 Mach when we will start our descent.
Now, you're sitting on the left here in the cockpit and your co-pilot's to your right. Neither of you has your hands on the joystick. Just how much flying is involved?
Well, we have two very good autopilots fitted on the aircraft, and we usually use just one of them to do the more tedious parts of the flight. Obviously, the takeoff is handled by myself or my co-pilot. Generally, put the autopilot in perhaps some 10 or 15 minutes after takeoff. The autopilot would then remain engaged until possibly 2 or 3 minutes before landing.
Well, I suppose you heard that. We're down. A perfect landing. We've arrived on the dot.
It's 18 minutes past 9 in the morning. Thank you for flying Concorde, the world's fastest aircraft. We have all enjoyed looking after you and hope that you will soon fly with British Airways again.
No longer is it one-upmanship just to say you flew first class. There's a cachet in having flown Concorde faster than the speed of a bullet, as Graham Hill did. It really is hard to keep still when you hear an infectious rhythm like that, but then nobody tries to in Brazil, where the samba and the bossa nova seem to form the very rhythm of life. Never more so, of course, than in February, when Rio reverberates to samba, to about 3 on the Richter scale. That's during one of the world's most glittering extravaganzas, Carnival. For many, rich and poor, the joyous highlight of the year. For the 16 samba schools, much of that year spent making preparations, designing and building floats, cutting and stitching hundreds of lavish costumes, and all with hopes of being judged the winners when the whole throbbing spectacular hits the streets of Rio. I very much envied Hugo Fay, who was there to see it all this year, with a little help from interpreter Patricia Kruntz, who guided him through the chaos.
It's Saturday, the day before the great spectacle at the Sambadrome, with processions of smaller parades snaking their way up and down the centre of the city. To say the least, there's an infectious madness in the air, because for most of the 9 million inhabitants of Rio, it's here on the streets, not in the Sambadrome or the many private and public balls, that the mayhem exists. I've been walking and driving through central and suburban Rio all day, and our first stop was a barracado. That's where the samba schools build their giant floats, and dozens of seamstresses sew the thousands of costumes which the sambista dancers will wear on the night of the grand parade.
What are we seeing here?
We're seeing the finishing of the costume for the field tomorrow.
For the parade tomorrow?
Yes, for the parade.
Which school are we in now?
União da Ilha.
Absolutely magnificent.
And these are for the Porta Bandeira and Mestre Sala, for the head.
For the heads, I
yes.
see.
It's the king and the queen of the school.
I see. So there's wonderful black or mulatto figures that are at the head of the floats
exactly.
during the defile, the
exactly.
parade. I see. We're now in an area which really looks like an enormous aircraft hangar, and it's absolutely filled with half-made floats depicting various themes again, political themes, economic themes, social themes. Absolutely extraordinary, huge, wild, devilish animals, about 30 feet high, representing different allegories, which, of course, will be explained slightly better in
the
Sambadrome. He's a wolfman, and he's laden down with enormous cruzeiro, notes of cruzeiros, representing, I suppose, inflation, the terrible Brazilian inflation. An enormous wing spanning about 15 feet. It'll be carried only by one person. That's just one dancer, one out of about 2,500. So you can imagine the size, the scale of the procession. So we're beginning to get an idea as to why the carnival is such a spectacle. If you think there are 16 of these schools, I'm just in one of them, and one begins to realize why it does in fact take two whole nights to see the whole parade through.
The sound of samba from Rio, Rio preparing to burst into carnival. In March, the mood was more reflective, at least in the Christian areas of the world, for the church's most important festival, Easter. Bridget Kendall was in the Holy Land, where the pilgrims and tourists can follow the steps of Christ along the Via Dolorosa, along which he stumbled under the burden of the cross that he carried to Calvary. Some modern experts, though, believe Christ's journey might have been a different one. Father Jerry Murphy O'Connor is a Roman Catholic priest who's lived in Jerusalem for more than 20 years, and he has a wealth of knowledge about the history of the Holy City. He guided Bridget Kendall along the route that he believed Christ followed.
Hey, watch it. Along, along. Hey.
It would have looked like this, the street with arches and two or three-story buildings, really making the street seem very closed in and crowded.
Yes, exactly the same. Very, very narrow. And it's only when you recognize how narrow the street is that you appreciate the problem. Because he didn't carry a cross, as in our representations. He had the beam strapped to his shoulders so that his arms were stretched out horizontally. What that means is you can't walk down a street like that. You see, all you can do is shuffle sideways. There's no other room. It means that you can't see the rough spots in the street. You can't see the steps. And it means you inevitably fall, and when you fall, of course, you get your arms tied back, you can't protect your face. We're inclined to forget that this was torture.
So the different stations of the cross where his disciples and friends helped him and wiped the sweat from his brow and pick up the cross and so on, one should see that in the context of these very narrow streets.
Precisely, sure, a friend in the crowd could reach out to wipe his face. Carrying the cross, of course, is another matter. That works in the way we conceive it only if he has a cross slung over his shoulder, which was not true. So when we're told that Simon of Cyrene carried the cross, that I think is a dilution of the truth to make it more palatable to Christians, the average mediocre Christian. Because what happened, he must have carried Jesus. He must have put his arm under his shoulder and carried Jesus. And the cross is the only way it can have worked historically.
Well, we've now arrived at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And whichever was the path which Jesus was supposed to have taken, there seems to be very little dispute that this place here was where Jesus Christ was actually crucified. It's difficult to believe that this site where we are now was once outside, a quarry open to the air with a crowd standing looking up at this stone with a cross on it. Inside the church we have gone up some stone staircases to reach this level, which is, I suppose, half the height of the church. So we are actually on the level of the stone where Jesus was crucified.
Just here is the Greek Orthodox altar. Underneath the altar, set in the marble, is a circular hole, and put your hand through that and you touch the very top of the rock.
But right next to it, there's another altar which looks very different.
Here, where we're standing, is the Latin chapel. Very simple, dignified, dark. Whereas just beside it, no separation, is the Greek Orthodox chapel, which is a flaming conflagration of icons.
And so the Christian churches east and west share this perhaps most holy site in the Christian church.
To say that they share it is probably a little too polite, I think, because tensions within the church between the various Christian communities make it, to my mind, the most unchristian building I know. I find it very difficult to pray here. There's an atmosphere of suspicion.
The Roman Catholics and the Greeks, along with the Armenians, are the most important of the several churches which have rites of abode in the Holy Sepulchre, and they all defend those rites with vigour and even aggression. As I witnessed myself last Saturday, the Catholics, because it was Palm Saturday, had a special procession, but it was also the beginning of Lent for the Greeks and the Armenians. Orthodox Easter isn't until May. In mid-afternoon, the Armenians filed in third in line after the Catholics and the Greeks and began their Lenten service. But they'd hardly sung one chant when the organ suddenly started up and drowned them with a Catholic anthem. The black-hooded Armenian monks shook their fists in protest and sang louder. And then both sounds were suddenly deafened by a crash of Greek Orthodox bells. The result was acoustic chaos. Meanwhile, on the other side of the church, the Copts, who also have rites there, were bravely singing against the din. This year, there's over a month apart between the Roman and the Orthodox Easters. But next year, by chance, both Easters fall on the same day, and it's hard to see how the Holy Sepulchre will accommodate them all at once.
Bridget Kendall reporting from the religious melting pot that's Jerusalem. Eastern Europe is an unofficial reminder that we're on the threshold of spring. The heavy overcoats and scarves are banished to drawers and cupboards as we wait, sometimes in vain, for the long, sunny days. Almost as if to guarantee himself a period of sunshine, John Titmarsh forsook our sometimes contrary climate to head for Antigua. Those more prudent than myself perhaps wouldn't mention the Caribbean in the presence of cricket enthusiasts. It was a series of tests in the West Indies best forgotten by the English. At least 1986 had a happy ending for England's cricketers in Australia, when they succeeded quite brilliantly in retaining the Ashes. When John was in Antigua, we were already losing the series 4-0, and each time yet another English wicket fell, this sounded across the cricket ground.
Captain, the ship is sinking. Captain, the seas are up, oh yes.
It couldn't have done much for the already sagging morale. Naturally enough, John Titmarsh, accompanied by Michael Kay, deeply dedicated to the game, though both of them undeniably are, must have found it a mild relief to get away from the sound of falling wickets to see what else the island of Antigua had to offer. possibly with a view to buying themselves a souvenir of the Leeward Islands, they took themselves along to the local market.
Now, this is a scene I absolutely wouldn't miss, and I advise you not to if you're coming to Antigua. Very, very busy at the moment. Mainly fruit and vegetables where we are. Here, we've got watermelons and bananas and plantains and mangoes and pineapples and coconuts and cinnamon.
Cinnamon, of course, reminding us that Columbus came this way looking for the Spice Islands.
He'd have found it had he come shopping in this market today. I suppose quite a lot of this stuff also goes to markets in Britain.
But the most important thing, I think, was what people have been telling us. They're trying to revive agriculture here and actually go for cash crops rather than the old sugar cotton complex. They're now going for crops like these, which actually sell for cash to supply the hotels and the tourist industry.
Yes, otherwise they would, of course, have to pay to import these foods for the hotels, as you say.
It's a marvellous sight.
Lovely market, isn't it? How much are the mangoes?
$1.50 and $0.75.
And the papaya?
$2 a pound.
$2 a pound papaya, $1.50 for the mangoes. But most of this produce is grown on Antigua, is it?
Yes.
What time do you have to get up in the mornings to come and set out the market stall?
I just get up at 5 o'clock and worship first and then come. Sometime I reach here at 8:30.
Do you go to church before you start work every morning, then?
Well, I worship home. We have Wednesday morning and Sunday morning service.
You'll be in church on Sunday, certainly.
Yes.
Voices raised in song in Antigua. 30 million people might remember May very vividly as the month they'd never been quite so footsore. All over the world, men, women and children put on their running shoes to enter races over a distance of 6 miles. This was their way of helping raise money for the Starving of Africa in the Sport Aid event. It was masterminded by the pop singer Bob Geldof and raised £9 million in Britain alone. Bob came into the Outlook studio to give us some impression of the scale of Sport Aid, and particularly the contribution of one Omar Khalifa.
There's 104 countries actively at the moment involved, but if you can imagine again the romance of this runner leaving El Obeid in the west of Sudan, this devastated area, where he lights his Olympic torch from the dying embers of a refugee campfire, and he will then leave Khartoum for Athens, where he'll be met by runners from Marathon and Mount Olympus, and they'll add the Olympic flame, and then he'll run to various countries in the east and west and be met by the heads of state, including the Pope, Jaruzelski, Mitterrand, who will add the flame of liberty. And then he'll come here where we have a big deal, and then he'll go to New York, and when he runs up First Avenue, he'll light this rocket, and that's the signal for literally everyone to run.
Bob's galvanizing into action of people all over the world to raise funds for Africa in his original Band-Aid operation made him, predictably, I suppose, your choice for the Outlook Man of the Year at the end of last year, with Terry Waite, special envoy to the Archbishop of Canterbury, a close second. And whilst Bob Geldof was here in the studio, we managed to arrange a special link-up of your two favourites.
Yes, hello, Bob. This is Terry Waite speaking, not from Africa, down the line in the University of Essex where I've been speaking today.
Hi, Terry.
How are you?
I'm glad you only came second in Man of the Year.
Well, you only came first.
Proper order.
I'm very sorry I can't be with you today. I just want to give, you know, what little support I can to the next venture you're going to be engaged in. A marvellous example of how, you know, there's a lot of people in this world who really do want to see things change for the better, and are willing to do it if they're given a chance. You know, we're rooting for you on that day.
He's going to shave off his beard for Sport Aid.
I'm not shaving off my beard, but I'm just shaking the mothballs out of my tracksuit.
Thanks, Terry.
We live in an age, I suppose, where we tend to think it's only the big organisations or the very powerful who can actually change circumstances, and that's not true. I mean, the ordinary person, if they'll get up and begin to see how they can act creatively and utilize their creative ability, can do more than they're led to believe. And I think this is the principle that lies behind the things that Bob has tried to do, that I've tried to do.
I quite agree. I also think, though, by its nature, an individual can almost inevitably do more because they've got nothing to gain by their activities, or they've nothing to compromise themselves by their activities, unlike a government who must speak for the national interest. And therefore, unlike Terry, for example, Mrs. Thatcher can't go charging into Lebanon demanding that people who are innocent be released, because it immediately puts perhaps the country at risk, herself at risk, and various other things. That's not to defend them. I just think that, for example, both Terry and I are far more effective, for example, outside Parliament than being one of 500 voices where we will be stifled and subject to all sorts of whips.
And I think that's something I value more than anything, the fact that I can liaise with government but can be stand on my independence from any government, control by any government, payment by any government or anything of that nature. My independence is absolutely essential, as I guess yours is.
Absolutely.
Terry Waite meets Bob Geldof, not face-to-face, but courtesy of British Telecom. And communications were particularly dear to the hearts of Canadians this year. Transport and communication was the theme of Expo 86, in what I'm told is British Columbia's most appealing city, Vancouver. Expo 86 drew exhibitors from many countries and visitors, of course, including John Tidmarsh, armed, needless to say, with microphone. But he discovered that communications weren't purely the reserve of this gargantuan trade fair. It filtered into almost every aspect of life in British Columbia.
At 8:11, let's check the conditions out in the water with the Sea Patrol. Here's Grant Goff.
Well, thanks again, Terry, and good morning, everyone. Still have this overcast sky, but the visibility is very good. We can see clear across the Vancouver Island. Fishing is so far very poor. They just don't seem to be either very hungry or they're just not around. There have been a couple of...
Yes, most places outside. In the morning, the radio will give you the road report, the weather report, the rail report, the airport report. But here in Vancouver, in British Columbia, this is really the first place where I've ever heard the Sea Report, the Sea Patrol. It's, of course, about the fish, the salmon. Are they biting? Well, one man who always knows the answer to that is Finn Anthony, who for many years had a fishing program here in Vancouver. I've been trying to ring you for 2 days. I take it you've been out in your boat somewhere.
Oh, no, I've been playing golf. Now, if you believe that, I'll sell you a bridge. Of course I've been fishing. This is the time of the year for it.
Fishing and the great outdoors, communicating with nature, that's really deep in the British Columbian soul, isn't it?
Yes, a lot of British Columbians do that kind of communication, John, with the outdoors.
Fishing also fits into the other theme of Expo 86, and that's transport, because it's changed greatly from years ago when the canoe and the kayak that the Indian and the Inuit were used for fishing, and today when people like you go off in float planes, seaplanes.
Yes, and I remember talking to an old Indian chief, and he related to me the story of when he was a young boy, I guess he was about 11 or 12 years old, his grandfather took him from Vancouver about 300 miles north up the coast in an 18-foot planked boat, open boat, rowboat with a jury-rigged sail on it, and they went north to catch the salmon. They got a nickel a piece for sockeye salmon, and they made $50 a day. And this was in an 18-foot open boat, 300 miles north. Now, that was a form of transportation that I'm sure you wouldn't want to experience, nor would I. It would be all right, I suppose, if you stayed close to shore, but you can't do it when you're going up the coast of British Columbia. You have to stay far out or you're on the rocks.
Have you seen the film in the British Columbia Pavilion at Expo?
Yes, I have.
It gives you such a wonderful feeling about this part of the world.
Well, you know, when you live in a city the size of Vancouver, and we're a million, I guess, in the greater area, you forget about the extent of this province. And British Columbia is as large as Washington, Oregon, California, part of Montana, and contains only the population of San Diego. And that population, 90% of it, is within a 150-mile radius stuck way down in the corner of the province. If you and I started to walk now, north, in a straight line, I doubt if we would find another living human being for 1,000 miles.
Inuit throat music. The more familiar strains of the wedding march was one of the dominant themes of the year on this side of the Atlantic for that glittering occasion, the royal wedding, the marriage of Prince Andrew, the Queen's second son, to Miss Sarah Ferguson, or as they'd become by the time the ceremonies were over, the Duke and Duchess of York. On television screens or through radios, millions of people followed the pomp and the ritual in almost every corner of the globe, and to me fell the happy task of presenting Outlook's royal wedding programme on the World Service, a high point of any broadcaster's career. Just before the wedding, the father of the bride, Major Ronald Ferguson, unlike his daughter, was quite prepared to reveal to Brian Johnston one or two secrets about his intended wardrobe for the occasion.
Actually, the tailcoat is quite fun, because it was made for my father in 1921. And although it is a black tailcoat, the beading has gone a bit green in places. Right. And I asked Sarah when she wanted me to get a new one. She said, not on your life. She said, you were married twice in it. And you've been to every wedding where I've seen you in it. And he said, no, I want you to wear that.
Have you had to have it altered?
No. The waistcoat's been let out.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah, because it's beginning to crease a bit. But the actual coat hasn't.
Yeah.
It's under repair at the moment. The beading's gone a bit.
Well, that's yours. Were you consulted about Sarah's wedding dress at all, or is it entirely her dress?
I haven't the slightest idea what the wedding dress is at this moment. Neither do I want to know what it is until such time as I see her about to get in the carriage. That'll be the first time. I haven't the slightest idea what it looks like. And even if she wanted to tell me, I wouldn't listen.
Every fashion expert had been giving his or her opinion on the likely style of the royal wedding dress. It was the best-kept secret of the year, and how breathtaking it turned out to be. As the bride arrived outside Westminster Abbey, Susie Menkes, fashion editor of the Times newspaper, was with Sue McGregor, eager to be the first to get a close-up of the detail.
We can now see the magnificent glass coach. It is traditionally the one loaned by the sovereign for royal brides. The Queen Mother used it in 1923 when she was married. Much more recently, Princess Anne used it. The Princess of Wales, too, used it not long ago. We can now see Sarah Ferguson inside the glass coach. It allows maximum viewing for us, which is splendid. Her father's looking just as excited as she is. And Susie, you can see that the dress is as magnificent as we hoped. And tell us, is there a tiara or is there not?
There is a symphony of flowers here, a lovely flowered headdress, but I think I can see diamonds sparkling behind it. There are also lots of sparkles on the dress, a very Renaissance embroidery on the bodice of this clotted cream satin dress. Wonderful embroidery that seems to be taking up the theme of Sarah's coat of arms. There are bees and a thistle just as she's getting out of a coach now.
Indeed, and she's holding a hoop, which is rather charming. Instead of a traditional bouquet, a hoop made of white flowers. She's just stepping out of the glass coach now, and we can see that the back of the dress is quite magnificently embroidered. There's a very long train.
There's a marvellous bow at the back of the dress. In fact, the train is starting from the bow at the back and sort of falling on from there. And the train, which now is just being laid out, is also very heavily embroidered with the motifs of Sarah's own coat of arms, the thistles and the bees.
She has, in fact, got a naval motif woven into the back of this beautiful dress. There's a heart, there are bees, there is a large A for Andrew, and the back of the dress itself, the embroidery seems to drop down from bows at the shoulder as well, which is very Fergie, isn't it? Bows everywhere.
Yes, it's a very fitted bodice, and she's wearing her hair down for the day, which I think people will be pleased to see that.
The veil is now being spread on top of the train, and any moment now, as Sarah Ferguson enters the Abbey as a commoner, as a non-princess, a non-duchess, as she enters the Abbey, I know we're going to hear the fanfare from inside.
Slowly and gracefully, Sarah Ferguson, accompanied by her father, walked up the aisle of the Abbey to take the wedding vows. As she uttered the words, "I do," the crowds who thronged the streets gave voice to a mighty cheer that echoed right across this capital city. Within the Abbey, as Miss Sarah Ferguson became the Duchess of York, the choir sang the motet by William Mackay, "Await for thy loving kindness, O Lord."
Alleluia, Alleluia, Alleluia,
A memory of a summer which many of us will treasure forever. July the 23rd, 1986. Throughout the year, we didn't allow you to forget it was the 40th anniversary of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. It kept our secretaries doubly busy. They were inundated with postage stamps by the tens of thousands, all of which would be sorted out to go to auction. The money raised would help UNICEF in its program of immunization against the six major killer diseases afflicting children: measles, whooping cough, tetanus, polio, tuberculosis, and diphtheria. Your response really was heartwarming, and the first auction took place in the sale rooms of Phillips in London on the last day of July.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this, which is the last stamp sale of the 85-86 season. As you'll see from the catalogue, we are giving our services for the first 38 lots free, and we hope indeed that you will be generous, because all of the proceeds, as I've said, will be going to UNICEF. We start, without more ado, lot number one, and this opens at £50. Any advance? 52. Any more for it? 55, 58, 60, 62, 65, 68, 70, 2, 75, 78, 80, 2, 5, 8. £88, 90 new place, 92, 95, 98, 100, and 5, 10, 15, 120, 5. Any more for this? £125 on my left at £125 by 703.
I won't forget the first child who I met, who really obviously didn't have a mother or father or a relative in Somalia. Nobody to turn to, and kind of suddenly turned to me and held on to me for a whole day. I won't forget that little hand on clutching my finger.
Unfortunately, funds are always very short. In point of fact, a great deal that UNICEF does, in a really very self-sacrificing and altruistic way, simply because of the devotion of the people who work for it, a great deal of it is really the responsibilities of us all, in other words, of government.
The voices of two of the Goodwill Ambassadors for UNICEF, Liv Ullmann and Peter Ustinov, very much involved in helping to raise funds to secure the lives of millions of youngsters. Let me say again that we were very touched by your response. The first auction of stamps raised £3,271. In November, it was time once again for packing suitcases, notebooks and microphones at short notice, when Outlook made its way to the fringe of the Arctic Circle.
Here I am born and bred. I have come to many, many other countries, and lovely countries, and very suitable to be there and live there. But I would always come back. Here, Iceland is warm in my heart. I would say that the coldest part of our country is the name, Iceland.
A resident of the capital, Reykjavik, enthuses about his country. Well, Reykjavik seemed in danger of sinking into the North Atlantic under the weight of the huge press corps, which suddenly arrived in November for that hastily convened meeting between President Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev. The pre-summit summit, as it was dubbed, although the hoped-for summit didn't materialise. John Tidmarsh took the opportunity of seeing more of this fascinating land of geysers, volcanoes, lava fields and glaciers, and of wrestling with the language.
I must just introduce you, first of all, Gudrun Anjar's daughter.
Agnar's daughter.
Agnar's daughter.
Yes.
Forgive me.
One of three members of the Alting, the Icelandic parliament, representing the Women's Alliance, and that's an exclusively female political party. It came into being in 1983 to highlight what it called the intolerably low proportion of women in political office. But as Miss Agnar's daughter explains, it all started a little earlier with a series of women's strikes.
In 1975, the International Year of Women, there were lots of things planned in Iceland, and one of them was a day off for women. And 25,000 women turned up to the largest outdoor meeting in the city centre. These women left their homes, they left their places of work, the children were left with the husbands or their fathers, and they, of course, could not carry out a full day's job because of that. So, virtually, I think women put the country to a standstill. It was all done in a jolly sort of pleasant atmosphere.
You didn't get too much aggravation from the men, then?
I don't think so, no. Now, of course, we have a woman who's the president. A woman who carries out her job in a beautiful, gracious manner. and is applied to all her countrymen. And I want to tell you a little ray of hope. It's a little story about how important it is for women and men to have role models. Soon after Vigdís Finnbogadóttir, our president, was elected, she appeared on television, and a little boy was watching, and he asked his mother, "Mommy, who's that?" And the mother said, "This is Vigdís, my dear. This is our new president." And he said, "Fancy that, a woman president." Then another little boy, a few years later, watched another television set, and there was a man on the news. And he asked his mother, "Who is that, mommy?" And she said, "Oh, this is Reagan, my dear. This is Ronald Reagan, president of the United States." And the boy said, "Fancy that, a man president?"
You made it up.
I didn't. No, I didn't.
Talking of Mr. Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev, a young man was saying to me earlier that if he had his way, he'd send Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Reagan off on holiday together, right into the interior of Iceland, where they would be so close to nature in its most dramatic form.
Yes, I would agree with this young man. I happen to be so lucky to be there myself this summer. I would certainly agree, and I would add to his wishes. I wish they would also lie together in one of the hot springs, the beautiful warm springs of Iceland, relax and listen to one another and come to an agreement.
Communal bathing, yes.
It would facilitate the result, I think.
Gudjon Agnarsdóttir. It was to warmer climes that I took wing as the year drew towards its close. There's a saying that one should never go back. Well, I did just that and returned to Kenya, where I'd spent my earliest years in radio. Things had changed, not always for the better. Still, it must be one of the African continent's most beautiful countries, and it guarantees you a host of entries for your album of memories. There's an especially vivid one for me. At the Kikorok Lodge in the Masai Mara Game Reserve on the border of Tanzania, we were up before dawn, a short drive by safari van, and we were soon aboard another form of transport.
Well, we're airborne at last, as you might have gathered, in this huge, hot air-filled balloon. And we're suspended under it in what looks a diminutive basket, but I'm assured that this is quite safe by the pilot, Alan Shaw. It isn't too flimsy for holding all these people.
No, no. In fact, this traditional wicker design is really the best thing for ballooning because it's light, flexible and strong. And they've tried various other materials, aluminium, fiberglass and so on, but this really is the best material.
What sort of speed are we gaining height?
We're climbing quite slowly. We're just about levelling off, and I'm going to have to burn again, so just hold on. The thing about these balloons is about a 10 or 15 second delay in between turning the burner on and it taking effect, so one has to anticipate. But we're moving across the ground, I suppose, at sort of bicycle riding speed, and climbing just gently at about 100 feet a minute, very slowly. We're looking out here for the game. You can see wildebeest down below, waterbuck over there, impala, tommies, vultures sitting in the trees down below there, or in fact marabou stork as well.
It's an amazing ride, isn't it? Absolutely silent, gliding across the Masai Mara. No engine to be heard, just those gas burners from time to time. That's how you control the altitude,
is
it?
That's right. I'm going to have to do it again now. See, there's some zebra over there.
Oh, yes, quite a large herd, about 20, 25, grazing away. The animals, I presume, get accustomed to this huge red and yellow thing gliding above them, do they?
They seem to. They're certainly the ones that live around here, close to the lodge, and a resident here, seem to accept it quite happily. They don't take very much notice of it. The hills that you can see over there are the hills of Tanzania. There's a river called the Sand River, which is more or less marks the border between Kenya and Tanzania. And so if we go over that way, and we'll be making an international flight, so I hope you've all got your passports and visas in order. But that's the Serengeti carrying on down there. And of course, the Mara here is part of the Serengeti ecosystem.
Lion.
Oh, look. See the lions there trying to catch the buffalo. Oh, yeah. Just on the road.
Wow,
okay. Two lionesses having a go at a buffalo. This is exciting stuff. Oh. It's not very often that we get to see this. The buffalo's gone into the bushes now. I think it's trying to hide from the from the lions, but there's a lot of activity going on in there. You don't really think of this fight for survival that goes on out here until you see something like that, and the fact that, you know, a buffalo has to fight for its life before breakfast. See the elephants over here? A whole, quite a number of elephants. One, two, three, four, five.
Isn't this exciting?
Oh, there's a lion.
Giraffe are very curious, look. They're watching us as we move.
Yes, giraffe are very curious animals. There's another one watching us quite closely. See, we're just above treetop height here, drifting along.
You can see every detail.
That's right.
Incredible.
This is a kind of bird's eye view of the world here. We can check out and see if there are any nests in these trees. Sometimes see owls sitting in the tops of trees. They like to watch the balloon go by. There's a little monkey sitting in the top of that one. Yes, go ahead, crew.
Landing in the hole, are landing on the other side.
No, I'm going to cross the creek and land on the other side. The crew have to go around in order to get across this creek.
Got to keep burning so that we make sure we do go above the trees. There's quite a tall looking one there. I hope we're going to miss it.
I think we will. We've done it a couple of times before. All right, if you'd just like to turn around now and take your landing positions.
This is where we crouch down in the basket, hang on to the rope, and see the grass rushing beneath us through the weave of the basket. There we are. Oh, touchdown. Quite gentle. Oh, not bad at all. Quite a good landing, wasn't it, Halima?
Terrible, my God.
Man, beautiful ride.
Jolly good.
Wasn't
yes,
it great? That was certainly the highlight of my year, floating silently over the Serengeti at little more than tree height. I doubt the next 365 days can bring anything to match it. We'll see. That's the future. Thank you for joining us to relive a few moments of the recent past, some Outlook highlights of 1986. Colin Hamilton saying goodbye on an East African note, or a collection of them, the pop group from Nairobi, Muungwana, whose album of late 1986 should provide them with a fruitful 1987.
Mwingine nasema bila pombe hawezi lala. Nakunywa bwana kesho jini siku ya kazi. Nakunywa bwana kesho jini siku ya kazi. Maisha ya pombe yameharibu wengi. Vibaya sana bibi akakitoroka. Na ukiwa na bibi atukiwa mjinga sineno. Na ukiwa na bibi atukiwa mjinga sineno. Sababu ya pombe umeona wengine wakora. Sababu ya pombe umeona wengine wauni. Sababu ya pombe umeona wengine waizi. Kiu ya pombe imefanya we mjanja.
kiu ya pombe imefanya awe mujanja. Pombe ni pombe, hakuna sielewezeka. Pombe ni pombe, hakuna pombe mzuri. Wengine napigwa kila siku kwa pombe. Mtu mlevi na tumbo hana chakula. Pombe nafanya wengine huwa wajanja. Pombe nafanya mtu akumbuki nyumbani. Wengine ukopa na mwisho ashindwe kulipa. Wengine ukunywa walala steji ya basi. Wengine ukunywa walala steji ya basi.